The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Not violating the true self. When the layman arrived at Zen Master Chang Tzu's place, the monks were assembling for a discourse as he entered the temple grounds. The layman stood outside as the monks approached the lecture hall and said, "Each one of you would do well to speak from your own experience." As Chang Tzu addressed the assembly, the layman stood to the right side of the dais. When the discourse was finished, a monk asked, "Could the master please speak without violating his true self?" Chang Tzu said, "Are you acquainted with Mr. Pang?" The monk said, "I am not acquainted with him." Thereupon, the layman grabbed the monk by the lapels and said, "Is it that hard? Is it that hard?" The monk could not reply, and the layman let go of him. Later, Chang Tzu asked the layman, "Would it be worthwhile taking the stick to that monk?" The layman said, "What have you been waiting for?" Chang Tzu said, "The layman only knows how to work with an awl. He doesn't know how to work with a chisel." The layman said, "Then you wouldn't say something meaningful to a person if someone else overhearing it couldn't understand it." Chang Tzu said, "Why wouldn't someone else understand it?" The layman said, "The master only knows how to work with a chisel. He doesn't know how to work with an awl." So, what's all this about a chisel and an awl? This is a story that is not in any of the koan collections that we use. I read a story, a koan, a week or so ago that about Layman Pang that was in one of our collections in the Blue Cliff Record, but this one did not make it into any of our collections, but I think it's quite an interesting koan, and so I want to explore it with you a little bit this morning. So Layman Pang, just a reminder that he is our greatest probably lay ancestor, certainly the greatest of the Chinese, of the Chan tradition of Zen. And he lived in 8th century China and was a great inspiration to lay practitioners of his age and to lay practitioners ever since. And many of the stories or koans about Layman Pang feature him as this one does, with an ordained priest who is a lineage holder, and show him having a dharma combat of sorts on equal footing with the ordained priest that he's speaking with, always standing his ground, often getting, as in this koan, the last word. And so, what are these two teachers, one ordained and official, one not ordained, one lay and kind of a wandering teacher who pops in here and there. What are they debating about? One says the layman only knows how to work with an awl. He doesn't know how to work with a chisel. And the layman answers, "The master only knows how to work with a chisel. He doesn't know how to work with an awl." So let's think about that for a moment. The awl punches through with a single well-aimed blow, pierces right through. The chisel does this slow work of filing away at obstructions, slowly removing obstructions. And these seem to represent two different approaches to teaching in the koan, as indeed they do. These are the two approaches to teaching and to practicing Zen that we heard about in the reading we did from the great Korean teacher, Chinul. from a few centuries later, from the 12th century, who talks about sudden and gradual approaches. And obviously the all represents, with its moment of piercing right through, the sudden approach, and the chisel represents the gradual approach. Which is it? Which do we choose? What do we practice? What's our Zen? Something more about Layman Peng. Now, the interesting thing is that Layman Peng could have represented either approach. Layman Peng had two principal teachers, two of the greatest teachers of the 8th century. One was Shito, and one was Matsu. And we hear about both of those in our koan collections. Both of them, Shito and Matsu, were Dharma grandsons, that is, the Dharma heirs of the Dharma heirs of the sixth Zen ancestor, Wei Nong. And it's said that all living Zen teachers trace their lineage back to Wei Nong. And it's also said that all living Zen teachers either trace their lineage back to Shito or to Matsu. So, yeah, so some split back there in the 8th century. No longer one school, but now two streams flowing out from the great source that goes from Bodhidharma, the first Zen ancestor, to Wei Nong, the sixth Zen ancestor. And this split was partly just about this question of sudden versus gradual, of gradual versus sudden practice, gradual versus sudden awakening. Shito represented the gradual way. And his, follow me here, Dharma great-grandson, that is the Dharma heir of the Dharma heir, of Shito's Dharma heir, was Dongshan. And Dongshan, the first syllable in Dongshan, is the second syllable in the school of Cao Dong, which became in Japanese Soto. So Soto Zen traces itself back to Shito through his Dharma great-grandson, Dongshan. Matsu also had a famous Dharma great-grandson, and that the Dharma heir of the Dharma heir of his Dharma heir, and that was Lin Ji. And the Japanese pronounce Lin Ji Rinzai. And so there we have the two great modern Zen schools of Soto and Rinzai, one tracing itself back to Shito and one to Matsu. And here's good old Layman Peng, the layman who doesn't appear in these lineage charts, who got to study with both. But he studied first with Shito and then with Matsu, and maybe for that reason he is representing the sudden approach associated with Matsu in this koan. Matsu, who allegedly was the teacher in the tradition that brought shouts and blows into Zen as a way of facilitating this piercing through of the all, this sudden, wake up! What are you waiting for? What is the student in this koan waiting for? What am I waiting for? What are you waiting for? What? So that's Matsu. And Shito, who Layman Peng had studied with earlier. No hurry. No hurry. Let's just sit some more. Let's see what happens. When the student, the student asking the question speaks, Layman Peng challenges him and pushes him towards some kind of sudden response. The layman grabbed the monk by the lapels. There's that physicality that goes with the Matsu approach. And said, does a robe really have lapels? I guess something like lapels. It wasn't by the Roksu, at least. And said, is it that hard? Is it that hard? There's a little bracketed remark. Is it that hard to be acquainted with me? That's kind of misleading, isn't it? Is it that hard? He's talking about what is at the heart of the monk's practice. Pursuit of understanding, of realization, of total intimacy with his own Buddha nature, of total revelation in his mind of the Dharma. Is it that hard? Is it that hard? And the monk is frozen, as often happens to students in these koans, and as often happens to us in Boundless Way Zen. I don't accept myself from this process. And Changsu says to Layman Peng, would it be worthwhile taking the stick to that monk? Yeah, take him out to the back. And what do you think? Does this monk show some promise? Is he a live one? Is this someone who's maybe teetering at the brink? Is this someone that it would be worth special attention? Notice that Changsu treats Layman Peng as his equal with a lot of respect. I'm asking you. You're the kind of person that would know. Here I am, you know, a solitary teacher of all these monks, and now you come with your great realization, and I'd like a little help. For the purposes of the binaries in this koan, you probably guess this Changsu, of course, is a Brahma heir of Shito. So he's with this gradual approach. And so Pang says to him, what have you been waiting for? What do you mean, is he ready? What have you been waiting for? Yet he doesn't have Buddha nature. He doesn't already have everything he needs. He doesn't just need one well-timed blow of that all. What are you waiting for? And Changsu says, you know, there's two ways of doing this. The layman only knows how to work with an awl. He doesn't know how to work with a chisel. Maybe Changsu doesn't know that Pang also studied with Shito. I'm not sure. It's kind of mysterious that he seems not to know that at this moment. Or maybe he feels that Pang has over-identified with the school of Matsu, with the way of Matsu, that he's really helping to bring into Chan practice, Zen practice. And so the layman answers in this kind of cryptic way, then you wouldn't say something meaningful to a person if someone else overhearing it couldn't understand it. Interesting moment in the koan, right? One way to understand that is, so you're going to wait till everybody's kind of all caught up in the same place, not testing anyone's readiness. Just more of the slow work of the file. And Changsu doesn't quite get this. Why wouldn't someone understand it? Why would one person understand it and not the another? Why does the all break through here and not there? And Pang gets the last word. The master only knows how to work with a chisel. He doesn't know how to work with an awl. So, all this sounds really kind of binary and categorical for Zen, doesn't it? Isn't that kind of a problem now with this koan and the way that it's developing? Can't quite be right, can it? And it's not. It is way too binary. And so I like to think, not that this is some knockdown, drag out Dharma combat, but that these are two teachers, very different kinds of teachers, a different status, one ordained, one lay, that each appreciate the other's realization, each appreciate the other's teaching, and this is a game that they play, and maybe not the first time they played it, maybe not the last time they'll play it, and they like to test each other and tease each other a little, because they do have different approaches, but they know that both of these approaches go to the same place. They also know that these approaches are not incompatible. After all, Layman Pan was the student of Shito before he was the student of Matsu, and he had great realizations with both of them. No need to rank these hierarchically and say, well, the one with Matsu must have been better, must have been deeper. I don't think that that's a useful way to think about this koan or to think about the history of our practice, which has often come to blows over this question of sudden and gradual. Well, this has been a perennial question for Zen teachers and Zen schools and Zen practitioners going back over 1,000 years. So this is not a new issue, and it's still very much a living issue. And so really the question is, so nice story. We could say a lot more about the historical figures involved and trace out their lineages in more detail, but let's not waste our time. The question comes down to, what's my practice? What's your practice? And what are we doing here as a school of Zen in Boundless Way Zen? How do we relate to this age-old distinction between the all and the file and between sudden and gradual? I can say that my own practice started out very much as a practice of the file. As some of you know, because I've said it before, when I was a very young person, when I was just 18, I spent most of a year at the San Francisco Zen Center, which was very, very much a Soto Zen center, devoted, in fact, to bringing Soto Zen from Japan to America. And we never, ever worked on a koan. In fact, we hardly ever had interviews with any teachers. Our work was the work of the file, to just sit. We would sit three or four times a day, 40 minutes at a time, just following the breath, maintaining the posture. Slow, 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 steady work. And this was what Zen was to me at that age and in that place and at that time. It's what was being taught me, and I accepted it fully. And I thought when I came back to Zen practice, I took only 30 years off. And when I came back after that brief hiatus, I thought that I would continue to do the work of the file. And I loved Boundless Way Zen from the moment I discovered it. And one of the things I liked about it was, okay, so both of these approaches are valid in Boundless Way Zen. And, of course, since I'm really at heart a Soto practitioner, this is what I'll do. And so for a while I did that, and I missed many opportunities to have interviews with our great founding teacher, along with David and Melissa, the third of our great founding teachers, James Ford. I didn't go in for interviews with him. What was I going to talk about? You know, my breath. It's I know how to do breath counting. I did it all those months. All those periods at San Francisco, what's he going to tell me? And I miss these chances for these kinds of live encounters that we read about in the koans. I miss the chance to even consider doing a koan. And then I came to a week-long retreat, my first Boundless Way Zen retreat, a week-long retreat that back at Senexit House, that lovably deteriorating spot that for the last time we ever practiced there. And I met another great Boundless Way Zen teacher named Melissa Roshi, who said, why don't you do a koan while you're here? And I said, I don't want to do a koan. I didn't quite say it that way. I said, no, you know, my practice, I started out with Soto Zen, and my practice is really just sitting. And so, thank you, I'll do that. And Melissa said, I'd really like you to do a koan. How about just when you're here? Yeah, right. First one's free. And so, you know, I wanted to be a good sport. So I said, okay. So, well, you give me a koan then. And she gave me the koan mu. And, wow. Yeah. My whole life changed. And koan practice is so interesting because it involves these little, sometimes tiny, almost imperceptible, sometimes bigger, these little all punches. You know, we sit with a koan and we do that work of the file and we're not getting anywhere. And we wonder, are we worth a few blows of the stick? And then something punches through. A tiny little kensho, maybe a bigger one. Always a surprise. Always this, wait, how did I know that? Wait, how did I do that? No, don't worry about that. This is how a second way of studying our mind in Zen. There's the patient work and a work of loving patience on the cushion where we're just with the breath, just with the posture, just with the sounds and smells and feelings in the room, our emotions, those thoughts that come and go. And then there are these moments. And in Boundless Way Zen, we have chosen as a school to not exclude either one of these approaches. We do the work of the file and the work of the chisel. And as you may have gathered from the reading from Chunul, Chunul in 12th century Korea had a very similar idea. That there are splitters in history and there are lumpers. There are people that feel that they need to return to the original purity of their tradition by breaking away and doing something different or more concentrated. And there are people that feel that the tradition's is breaking apart and it needs to be pulled together again. And Chunul was one of the great synthesizers, and Korean Zen at this time and Korean Buddhism generally was in all these separate factions that weren't getting along. And Chunul made it his life's work to bring them together again. And so he tells us in the reading we did that sudden and gradual are both needed, that he calls them the two wheels of the cart. You this is a cart tied to an ox or a horse. You can make it go on two wheels, all right. You can't make it go on one. You know, so this is part of our inheritance from Chunul. And a century later, in the 13th century in Japan, Dogen, who we think of, right, as the founder of Japanese Soto Zen, and he was, also, I think, had this spirit. Because although he is the Soto founder, the one that brought Saodong to Japan and established Soto Zen, he also frequently uses koans in his Dharma talks in the Shobogenzo. And he did a koan collection, and he recognizes the value of the all. And his own experience included a wonderfully well-timed, well-placed blow of the all when he was sitting in the Zendo and heard words that opened everything up for him. And so Dogen talks about practice realization, right? We might as well say chisel all or gradual sudden. Practice realization. This is ultimately one activity, not two. Often very helpful to see them as two. To see ourselves moving effortlessly between one and the other. When one is needed, there it is. When the other is needed, there it is. But understanding that finally it's just one practice. This one practice that Dogen calls practice realization in one of his beautifully affected, hyphenated terms. When the layman arrived at Zen Master Chang Su's place, the monks were assembling for a discourse as he entered the temple grounds. The layman stood outside as the monks approached the lecture hall and said, "Each of you would do well to speak from your own experience." As Chang Su addressed the assembly, the layman stood to the right side of the dais. When the discourse was finished, a monk asked, "Could the master please speak without violating his true self?" Chang Su said, "Are you acquainted with Mr. Pang?" The monk said, "I am not acquainted with him." Thereupon the layman grabbed the monk by the lapels and said, "Is that hard? Is it that hard?" The monk couldn't reply, and the layman let go of him. Later, Chan Su asked the layman, "Would it be worthwhile taking the stick to that monk?" The layman said, "What have you been waiting for?" Chan Su said, "The layman only knows how to work with an awl. He doesn't know how to work with a chisel." The layman said, "Then you wouldn't say something meaningful to a person if someone else overhearing it couldn't understand it?" Chan Su said, "Why wouldn't someone else understand it?" The layman said, "The master only knows how to work with a chisel. He doesn't know how to work with an awl." Thank you. So now it will be your turn to be the monk. And we'll find out if you're acquainted with Mr. Pang. Please keep in mind that this talk is being recorded, and if you would like the recording to stop at any point, we will pause it. And please feel free, as some of you have already done, to sit comfortably during this period of dialogue. Jenny?
Well, your invitation to comment sounded kind of threatening.
Thank you for noticing.
But I didn't understand a word that you used repeatedly. File, like the tool that removes little bits?
Right.
Okay, all right.
The file.
That's my question.
Yeah, he was using that as the chisel, the slow method.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you said bile.
Bile? Bile, yeah.
Well, bile would work too. Yeah, we use just bile. In a different way. Bile is also a corrosive, so good. Yeah. So that was your question.
Yeah, that was my question. Don't hit me.
Ooh, so, that's so hard.
So file or all today.
Okay.
A-W-L, for those of you who don't know that English word.
Like an ice pick.
Hole puncher.
Well, that's very, very good. And I'm really glad you brought it back to our experience, especially here at Boundless Way Zen, because I've asked myself repeatedly, which path am I on, the slow path or the rapid path? And both are kind of working, but then again, both aren't working. So that's been my experience. So I keep, I guess, waiting for this sudden sort of magical kensho. And then, of course, what comes from that is initial bliss and maybe Zen sickness from that. I'm not sure that's the way to go either. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I just want to tell you that my experience has been working with both paths. And, so I'm glad you synthesized everything at the end.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Bill. And you know, really important that if we have these moments of realization where everything seems to be clear, that we see these not as the end of something, but as the start of something. And that's where Chinul and is agreeing with our school, that it's not, you know, that doesn't end anything. That wasn't the end point after all. For Chinul, that's really where you start. You take a few years and then you have a kind of a blow of the all. You have a realization. And then you spend years unpacking it. Years getting over what he calls these karmic habit energies that are very difficult to clear out. And it sounds like this is your practice. And I think the trick is if this is possible, to avoid the Zen sickness stage. I think you don't have to keep going through that.
Well, and I want to say too that all of you have already had an awakening experience. You would not be here unless something has touched your heart. It's when we hear enlightenment and kensho, we all make up some image that we're pretty sure we haven't had. Right? Because if I had that, but no one would do this work. Unless, because it doesn't make sense to do this work. It's not very pleasant a lot of the time, right? But something brings you here. And so I think much more helpful to one think of this beginningless awakening. This is a natural human experience. This is not a product of Zen, or I didn't start Zen till now, so, but this is, happens all the time. And then as we, enter our practice, to be open to the openings. You know, so you, taste your oatmeal. Oh, that's yummy. That's an awakening. Or you're working on koans and you can't get the answer, as Alan said so wonderfully. I can't get it. And then somehow it comes, something comes. Or if you're doing your breath, you're working hard and then suddenly it's not hard. And the breath is breathing itself. That is an opening. So please be careful. Yes, there is awakening. And we are changed by it, but it does not look like you think it does. And it is already here. You have already had it.
And there's a little implication that I've heard in what you said, that somehow or other, this is your choice, awakening through your own efforts, right?
Yeah, right.
I would like to... wipe that away. I would like to shake your lapels. it would be hard. but because that's a very subtle way that we harm ourselves. Because if we say it's up to me, then we set ourselves up for failure. You get it?
Yep.
Yeah. The other thing I want to say is that my teacher's teacher, my teacher's first teacher, so James Ford's first teacher, who was Jiyu Kennett Roshi, a woman. You wouldn't know by Jiyu and Kennett that name. We added her original name to our lineage chant to make it clear that not all our ancestors are men. Peggy was the name. So Peggy Roshi said, she wrote a book called Selling Water by the River. I love that title. Years later, she changed the title, and I thought that was unfortunate. But actually, she, now that I think of it, she changed it to a really good... She called it the Wild White Goose. Right? But originally it was Selling Water by the River. That's what we're doing here. That's what David was pointing out. Right? Every one of you is already a Buddha. And Buddhas look like you, feel like you, think like you, get lost like you. And so we set up these conditions. We give you the bottle, right? And the bottle is so simple. Zen instructions are very straightforward. And this is what Alan learned at the San Francisco Zen Center, and he repeated it in his talk. Sit upright and still and be with your breath and your body. Everything else is extra. Koans are extra. Shikantas are just sitting extra. This is the source of everything. This is the setup. These are the conditions. And then you go in, and I agree with you. We are both awl wielders and chisel wielders. And we decide which is right. So somebody like Alan comes in to see me who's used to being chiseled. Time for an awl. But somebody who's been doing the awl needs spaciousness. And it's not even that, it's not binary, I love that word, it's not even that. It's like, what is the person right in front of me needing right now? And
so another way to think about this duality is the different energies required in our practice. That we can't actually just determine, but in some ways to sit from the Soto perspective is to appreciate it's already done. Don't chase after anything. Why try why try to understand a koan? Right? Well, so in that fullness. And then there are times when our practice gets sort of dull where there has to be this energy of penetrating. What is it? Who am I? Why am I here? And in a sense, those different energies correspond to this sudden and gradual, and both are required.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, where does effort fit into this? Yeah. I think you just answered it.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
You got it. Yeah. Thank you, Bill. Yeah. What a wonderful question and demonstration.
I apparently started looking into the great matter through Jesus in the beginning, and one of the things, many things struck me in the same way things strike me here. My power is made perfect in weakness. There's nothing that can separate you from the love of God, like that, and this actual sinking into I'm not different, that I'm a part of, that I can't count myself out of that, sort of, when I came here, brought me, just kind of set me at a certain angle, I guess, like anything would, where even though there's the words that I can never remember, Kensho and Shunyata, and, you know, I knew that it didn't matter if I didn't know the words. And I just wanted to share that, because I think they're not two.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, thanks so much, Joanne. And sudden and gradual, just words. Soto and Rinzai, just words.
Yeah. Christian and Buddhist, just words. Because we're moving into a territory where words don't apply. And so we use these words, and human beings in all different traditions, to think that somehow Zen is better, or Zen is true and Christianity is not true, or something, to me doesn't make any sense. Human beings have approached this great mystery of the universe, of our lives, in many ways. So, like you, I resonate with so many of the teachings of Jesus and other people. It's like, oh yeah. Yeah.
And we have to be careful here about everything is one. That's sometimes what we call pernicious oneness, right? It's like, oh yeah, it doesn't matter, you, me, sudden, gradual, oh, they're nothing, nothing, nothing. But they actually are something. Christianity has things to offer that Buddhism doesn't. Buddhism has things to offer that Christianity doesn't. You have things to offer that I don't. I have things to offer that you don't. There is both uniqueness and sameness. Again, we have to be careful about getting caught in one side of a binary. Always. It's both, you know, we say one of our most profound teachings comes from one of our Indian ancestors, Nagarjuna, and he talks about the four different ways of viewing reality. So there is this and that. They're different. There is know this, know that. And there is neither this nor that, and also this and that. Just those the other two. But it's like the reason, you know, it sounds like a formula. But the mind gets caught in sameness, and it gets caught in differentiation, and it gets caught in non-binary, right? So this is, we're learning how to be flexible and accept the teachings that arise everywhere. Thank you.
Yeah. And I would add, if I could, Joanne, that we're here, I'm here, we're here because this is what works for us. And wherever we started from. And, you know, I grew up in the Episcopal Church, it stopped working for me. This really works for me. And so I think that's important too, that we honor what calls us and what works for us and what brings out our energies and what we can give our lives to.
But you can still go to church.
Yeah. Esther.
So I really appreciated your shout. The what? What are you waiting for? So we sit here and we have these two kinds of practices. And then in the rest of our lives, you know, as we go and move in and out of these two kinds of practices on the cushion and in our lives. And to, what are you waiting for from a place of connectedness and heart and of thinking that, also speak up and speak to that place in everyone, regardless of whether you think they have understanding or not. Mm. You know, bringing it forth and this action aspect of what we're doing here. So important and so difficult sometimes. Maybe that's where habit energies come in more. Thinking that certain conditions have to be right before. So that felt in the body. Right.
Thank you. I'm reminded when I was in graduate school, I made my own specialty because I was a Zen student and also a psychology student, and I thought I would write my thesis about the merging of those two. And then I forgot about it, you know, years passed, and then somebody in one of my mindfulness classes found my graduate thesis. Oh, so embarrassing. And said, I read it, it's so great. And I said, really? What is it about? I don't remember. And he said, you talk about two different kinds of practice. How did I know this? I'd only been practicing for a few years. And I talked about Manjushri and Kanzan, or Avalokiteshvara practice. And I knew that even then, right? It's so interesting. So Manjushri practice is wielding the sword and cutting off delusion. And Avalokiteshvara practice is opening. Everything is it. And that what I said apparently in this thesis, this guy told me, is that sometimes one is required and sometimes the other is required. And, you know, hearing this koan today, and actually in the talk yesterday, the most amazing talk that ever happened that didn't get recorded. Well, it turns out the first 13 minutes got recorded. It was actually no one's fault. It was the recorder's fault. You can blame somebody like the empty boat coming down and you start yelling at, you know, what are you going to crush into me? It's the same thing again, you know, that these two talks are in partnership. The two people talking from both sides who meet in that place. So we need Manjushri. Sometimes we just have to say, what? Mm-hmm. We have to just, you know, cut it out. Stop. Mm-hmm. And other times it's like, just open to everything. But if you only do one or you only do the other, in my view, you miss everything.
But one of the essential part of what I experienced in that moment was the what from that endless compassionate place, you know,
yes.
I feel that the Buddha's
right.
teaching come
That's
from.
Right.
It's like,
right.
what? It's like, does it make any sense? So it comes together in that moment too.
So Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara are two sides of the same teaching.
And I recently was looking at a Manjushri, actually David Hinton, our new favorite translator, many ways to look at the etymology of Manjushri, and usually we think of the sword, but one of the roots of Manjushri means the sweet light. So usually we think of this, just this fierceness, but I love this, this penetrating sweet light. So the what is not an aggressive or not, you know, you're wrong, but this great love manifests as a shout now and as a caress the next time. So thank you. On that note, let's come back to our Zazen.